afternoon. The specific adventure is I've been accustomed the last few weeks to just grabbing the laptop and going to work at the office, knowing there's a docking station there and, you know, everything. And so I left my computer bag home, and home is not around here. It's way back up beyond Loma Linda. So someone who happened to have a parallel cord lent it to me this morning but is not here this afternoon. So we will go with the presentation as long as the battery holds out. My guess would be with projection level, it's probably about an hour or so. And I think I can manage this presentation in about an hour. This is more than what I gave this morning for either of the sermons. It's a presentation of considerable substance. But we'll think of doing that in about an hour. And at that point, forget about the computer. I'll just come down and just gather among you and any questions that you have. If you have questions about the presentations this weekend, of course, those will be 100% appropriate. If you have questions on other subjects and I have an answer, I'll give one. If I don't have an answer, I'll make one up. So anyway, that's a promise. So yeah. So let me go right away to the presentation. I was thinking originally have questions in the middle of it, you know, sort of more like a class. But I think given the reality, the computer can offer us a lot. Let's run with that. And when the presentation's done, we can get our Bibles out and our questions and go after it in a more old-fashioned way. All right, a vision for the end-time remnant. By way of introduction, it's interesting that for the younger generation, and by that I mean people about 40 years old and younger, the so-called postmodern crowd, for the younger generation, the challenge of Adventism is different than it was for my generation. My generation, people didn't want to become Adventists because of Sabbath, you know, job issues, tithe, you know, don't need a second tax. State of the Dead, I thought for sure grandma was somewhere else, you know. Those were the tough issues. People would come to them and say, you know, that's a heavy price. I don't know if I want to go there. The younger generation doesn't seem to have a problem with those three issues nearly as much as my generation did. For them, the bigger issue seems to be remnant. And the reason remnant is an issue is to them, it sounds arrogant. It sounds prideful. Can an organization have pride or only individuals? There is such a thing as corporate pride, corporate selfishness. And one of the dangers in any institution, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is an institution. One of the dangers in any institution is a corporate selfishness that doesn't allow us to learn from others, that doesn't allow us to grow, because that might threaten the status quo and so on. So this is what our young people are seeing. I actually was a youth leader once. Wasn't all that long ago, actually. And I once asked the youth to just get in small groups and ask the question, what's the number one thing that would keep you from staying in the church when you become an adult? And they all gave virtually the same answer. It's people who act as if they had no faults. Biggest barrier to young people staying in the church is this aura of rightness and perfection that is contradicted by life at home, by reality, you see. So remnant has become a really tough issue for the younger generation, and that's going to be more and more percentage of the church as the years go by. So it's a topic that we need to address afresh, and in fact has been addressed at the level of the General Conference of a major committee that I've been a member of. And the things I'm going to share with you this afternoon are the best of what we've come up with in 5 years. Does that sound like fun? All right. You may not have heard of most of this. There's been a book published. The book covers a lot of this, but not every detail of what I'm going to share with you is in the book. I think there are some things that even angels fear to say. So, and I'm not an angel. So, all right, a vision for the end time remnant. It all goes back to Revelation 12, 17. That's a root text. And by the way, people sometimes wonder, what translation do you use? Well, you probably haven't seen it before, unless you went to my website, because on my website I have it there. But it's my own translation. And I do that not because my translation is better than anyone else's, but I try in the translation to reflect the way the Greek works. Okay, there are interpretive translations, very helpful, but if you're going to do serious study, it's helpful to see how the language itself plays within itself. And so I try in my translation to be as rigid to the original as possible without being unreadable. The dragon was angry with the woman, went away to make war with the remnant of her seed, those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus. And the question naturally is, who is the remnant? And what is the traditional answer that we have given? The Seventh-day Adventist Church. Okay? And that makes a lot of sense to us for reasons I'll show you in just a minute. But it doesn't play well in the wider world, because whenever we run into people who have all the answers, what do we know? They haven't faced all the problems. Right? The more confident you are, you have all the answers, the less likely it is that you actually explored the evidence. Or one of my mentors used to say, it isn't hard to have strong convictions on any topic as long as you're willing to ignore some of the evidence. You see? So, as a result, this remnant idea, you know, people say, come on, you know, be honest. Well, let's take a look. Here's what the book of Revelation has to say about the remnant. There are five items of identity. One is they come at the end of Earth's history. You see that from chapter 12. You go through the history of the church, and when you come to the end of time, that's where the remnant appears. They come at the close of Daniel's time prophecies. We saw that at 8 o'clock this morning. We took a look at Revelation 10 and saw how Daniel's time prophecies close, and then there's this end time gospel message that appears. The remnant possesses a prophetic visionary gift. There are a number of Adventists that dispute that. They're not being stupid or anything like that. There have been some serious challenges to that. I believe that that's the case, but I don't have time today to study that out with you. So you're going to have to take a few things on faith. What I'm giving you this afternoon is a product of 30 years of study in the original languages and in engagement with Adventist scholars, Catholic scholars, Protestant scholars, Jewish scholars, and Islamic scholars. So that doesn't mean it's right, but it means at least I've tried to look at the evidence, all the evidence, and not just part of the evidence, as people may see it from different angles. I believe, on the basis of that study, that a visionary prophetic gift will be an aspect of the remnant. And I believe that Revelation 12:17 shows that. Remnant is the object of worldwide attention. And finally, has a message of worldwide significance. Now, at this point, would you say, on the basis of those five characteristics, is the remnant the Seventh-day Adventist Church? Are we the object of worldwide attention? Not yet. All right. That's hopeful. Not yet. Yeah. Okay. Nor do we have a message at this point of worldwide significance. In a sense, it's familiar territory, and yet we'd have to look at that and say, well, it's not fully there yet. So there's a sense in which the remnant of Revelation is something yet bigger than what we have yet experienced, although it has a lot of characteristics of where we are. Message of the remnant. Now, this will be more encouraging to you, I think. There are eight messages in the crucial texts of Revelation that belong to that end-time remnant. The gospel, and I'll have the text up there. We could spend an hour on each of these. We don't have that time. So here's where a little bit of faith comes again. Daniel and Revelation. According to chapter 10, Daniel and Revelation, both of those books will have special role and significance at the end of time. The sanctuary, the heavenly sanctuary in particular, Revelation 11 brings that out. The remnant keep all the commandments of God. And the all there probably is the key element. A warning of end-time deception. We hinted at that at 11 o'clock hour, Revelation 13. Did not go in deep, but we discussed it briefly. There is a relationship with Jesus. They preach the hour of judgment, and there's a focus on the Sabbath. All right, now when you look at that, as a Seventh-day Adventist, you look at that, is that a fairly good summary of the Adventist message? Why do you suppose that's the case? Historically, the answer is the Adventist church arose in the attempt to carry out the mandate of Revelation. In other words, Adventist identity is grounded in the book of Revelation, whether we like it or whether we don't like it. The Adventist church, as we know it, is an attempt to lay out the message of the book of Revelation to the world. When you look at the remnant of Revelation, they are giving this eightfold message to the world. And that, to me, the most exciting part of this is simply, all right, Seventh-day Adventist Church, is that a flawed entity? One that is not perfect? Is that a hard question? Okay. Again, I think the more you know the church, the more you know the leadership of the church, you know they're wonderful people, but they're human beings. And people are not always treated right. Issues are not always handled right, and so forth. I think it's simply being honest to say so. However, is there any other body on earth that comes anywhere close to this? And if this is the prophesied, not by us, but by God, the prophesied message that will be of crucial significance at the end of time, where are you going to go to find it? If it isn't to the body of people that say, yes, we want to bring this message to the world, not because we're better than anyone else, but because this message needs to go. All right. So, this is the Revelation's remnant. It certainly has a lot of familiarity to anyone who's been a Seventh-day Adventist or is familiar with Seventh-day Adventist teaching. And the Seventh-day Adventist Church is a deliberate attempt to bring this message to the world. All right, so how can we understand this remnant concept? Is there some way that we can understand it so that the arrogance and all of that other stuff can move out of the way and people can see the mission of God, maybe overarching this? Let's take a look at the Old Testament. Now, this morning, in both of the sermons, we took a more exegetical approach. That means we took a text, we looked at that text, tried to understand that text in its context and also looking back to its pretext, the Old Testament. This afternoon, we're going to take a more theological approach. The remnant is an idea that's found throughout the Bible. We're going to look through the whole Bible, not going to spend the whole afternoon. We're going to look through the whole Bible quickly, get a better understanding of that remnant concept, and then we're going to go to history. And we're going to look at some fascinating new information that's coming out of the study of history that is beginning to confirm aspects of the great controversy story that history has never confirmed before. And that will be very exciting. Then we'll draw a conclusion and open it up to you. All right, remnant in the Old Testament. It all goes back to Father Abraham. God made a covenant with Abraham, but it was not a covenant for the benefit of Abraham. He made a covenant with Abraham for the world. Genesis 12:3. You are to be a blessing to the nations. All the nations of the world will be blessed through you. So somehow, through the covenant with Abraham, God would bless every nation on earth. In Exodus 19, he says to Israel, you are to be a kingdom of priests. What is a priest? What does a priest do? Stands between God and people, right? If you have a nation of priests, what kind of nation is that? A nation that stands between God and the other nations. You see? Israel was to be God's priest to the other nations of the world. Why? Why did God do that? His goal was to restore the Garden of Eden. If you read the story of Genesis and Exodus, God had a mission to restore the Garden of Eden, to get back to the perfect world that once was. Did that mission succeed with Israel? No. Garden of Eden still isn't here. So we know that it has not, that mission has not succeeded. He called Abraham, he called Israel for the world, but that was never fulfilled. You look at the Old Testament, you have the judges with all of their problems, Solomon, Jeroboam, Ahab, Manasseh, captivity, occupation. You look at the Old Testament, and rather than fulfilling that, it's a history of failure and a history of disgrace. So the Old Testament's not a pretty story of success. It's a gritty reality drama. And because Israel failed to carry out the promise of God, failed to obtain that promise, God had a plan B. You know what that plan B was? Remnant. God came up with the idea of remnant. Through a remnant of Israel, he would bring about the fulfillment of these promises. But here's something we've missed. Gerhard Hausel was probably the person who more than anyone else studied the remnant concept. And almost unknown to most people, because he actually wrote it up in non-Adventist publications. But in those publications, he said, remnant is not a single concept. It's actually a threefold concept. Remnant is more than one thing. When we hear remnant, we think Adventist church. But no, remnant's bigger than that. It's more than just a single concept. It's a threefold concept. And in going back to that and rediscovering that, we found a fascinating series of texts in the Old Testament regarding the remnant. First type of remnant that Hausel came up with is historical remnant. Now, historical remnant is when you're looking into the past, all right? You're standing at a particular point in history, and you're looking into the past, and you're saying, yeah, well, let me stop for a second. What is a remnant, first of all? In the Old Testament, remnant basically means survivors of a disaster. If an army comes against your city, and you've got a tribe of people, and you're the only people on earth that are related to each other, okay? An army comes in and tries to kill you off. Genocide. What is your best hope? That enough of you will survive to repopulate the tribe, right? That's the remnant. Kill off 90%, but if 10% survive, the tribe can repopulate itself. That's the core idea of remnant. And historical remnant is looking in the past and discovering that at some point in the past, God intervened and created survivors so that a particular tribe could move on, or a particular people could move on, or a particular belief could survive. So, for example, you have Noah from the flood. Noah's the first remnant in the Bible. It says, only Noah was left. That word left means remnant. Noah and his family were the only survivors of the flood. And God did that. So if you look into the past, you can date a remnant, you can count a remnant, you can name a remnant. It's all very clear because it's in the past and you can see God's hand. All right? So historical remnant is looking back in history and seeing that God has acted to bring out a people. Abraham was a remnant from the nations of the world in his day. Israel was a remnant that came out of Egypt. And then later on, Israel was those who survived when the Assyrians came and conquered. Let's take a look at this text, 2 Chronicles 30 and verse 6. It says, O people of Israel, return to the Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may turn again to the remnant of you who have escaped from the hand of the kings of Assyria. All right? Take a look at that text. Just look at it on the screen and answer this question. Is this remnant here faithful to God? Did I hear no? Anybody say yes? Okay, how do you know they're not faithful? God is calling the remnant to return to him. So historical remnants aren't necessarily faithful. They're usually a mixed bag, faithful people and unfaithful people. All right? So simply to be a remnant isn't something to brag about because you're not necessarily faithful to God. That you are a remnant is established by the work of God in your community. But over time, remnants sometimes lose their way, as Israel did, and have to be called back to God. So that's a historical remnant. Second type of remnant is the faithful remnant, and that's the present tense. Out of that historical remnant, when you bring it into today, some of those people are faithful and some are not. So out of Israel, some were faithful, some were not faithful. Take a look at 1 Kings 19. This is God talking to Elijah. Well, Elijah speaks first. Elijah said, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the people of Israel, this is the historical remnant, the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. So you see, how big was the remnant? According to Elijah, one person. You heard that saying? You know, I think everybody's gone to the dogs but you and me, and I'm starting to get worried about you. All right? That's where Elijah's at right now. Okay? But look what God says to him. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So there is a faithful remnant. At any point in history, there are those among the historical remnants who are faithful. Are they visible to human eyes? Not always. So that's the interesting thing. Here you have a prophet of God who doesn't know there's 7,000 others beside himself that are faithful to God. You see, so faithful remnants, present tense remnants, are not visible in the way that historical remnants are. You can't necessarily count them. We don't know in this room, for example, how many of us are faithful and how many are not. There's no way that we can tell that right now. Faithful remnant is known by God. They are part of a historical remnant, but they are the ones that God knows belong to him. Sometimes in the Old Testament, that faithful remnant's projected into the future. Isaiah 10, 20 to 22. In that day, the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean on him who struck them, but they will lean on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. So God projects into the future here. He says, in that day, the remnant will lean on the Lord. They will return to the Lord. So God projects a future where the faithful remnant will be used by God in a special way. So the faithful remnant concept is usually present tense, but sometimes God projects it into the future. Third type of remnant is the eschatological remnant, the end time remnant, and that's totally future tense. God projects into the future that at some future time there will be a remnant. And this remnant connects, I think, with the previous one, as you will see. Isaiah 66, verses 19 and 20. And I will set a sign among them, and from them I will send survivors to the nations. That word survivors is another remnant word. Survivors to the nations. What nations? The nations that have not heard my fame or seen my glory. So what nations are they? Unbelievers, right? Not part of Israel. Outsiders. And they, the faithful remnant, shall declare my glory among the nations who have not known God. And they shall bring, catch this, all your brothers from all the nations as an offering to the Lord, to my holy mountain, Jerusalem. Is that glorious? Here's the image that God will use a faithful portion of his people to go out to people who have never heard, people who have no idea, people who are totally other. And out of them will come brothers and sisters back to Jerusalem. So this is a vision of something bigger, more international, I would say surprising, unpredictable. The future remnants in the Old Testament are always surprises. They're always something bigger, something unexpected. So the remnant promise is not just with a certain historical body or even a handful in the present, but in the future, something way bigger is envisioned. In fact, let's go to a text that's so amazing, most people have never heard of it because they don't know what to do with it. This text blows your mind. In that day, that's Isaiah's favorite end time phrase, in that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Now, who are these guys, Egypt and Assyria? They're the superpowers of the ancient world and Israel's great enemies. These are the bad guys. The Assyrians will go to Egypt and the Egyptians to Assyria. The Egyptians and Assyrians will worship together. That's pretty hard to imagine. But what are they worshiping? Verse 24, in that day, Israel will be the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing on the earth. Does that sound familiar? Who's supposed to be the blessing on the earth? Israel and Abraham. Isaiah has taken the promise to Abraham and expanded it to Egypt and Assyria. This is unheard of in the Old Testament and unheard of pretty much in Jewish thinking even today, that the promise to Abraham could somehow be expanded to others. Notice verse 25. The Lord Almighty will bless them, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance. Have you ever seen a text like this before? It's an amazing text. Suddenly, the promise to Abraham and Israel is expanded to their great enemies, and that God will use the three to reach out to the world. That is a vision of remnant that is shocking. I'm sure it was shocking to Isaiah. So let's summarize here. In the Old Testament, The historical remnant, the greatest one, would be Israel of the Exodus. So when you look back in the Old Testament, you see that Israel came up out of Egypt. That's a work of God. You can name that people. You can count them. You can date it historically. It's all clear. Who is the faithful remnant in Isaiah's day? Would be those people who in Babylon remain faithful to God, in spite of exile and persecution and everything else. That wouldn't be the whole people, but it would be the faithful ones of the people. Who is the eschatological remnant for Isaiah? It would come after the return from Babylon, and ultimately it would be the church. I'll ask you this question. If God had showed Isaiah the church with all these nations of the world represented, if God had said to Isaiah, you know, one day there's going to be 2 billion people who read your book and live by it in one form or another, what would Isaiah have said? Never saw it coming. I had this text in Isaiah 19. This is way bigger than I ever thought. You see? So the eschatological remnant is bigger, more international, unexpected, surprise, unpredictable. Now here's what we never did before. A few people were aware of some of this Old Testament information. We never applied it to the New. The New Testament has remnant as well. And the place to go is in the book of Romans. Studying that for a Sabbath school lesson. We're going to get there soon. Romans chapter 11. But take a look at this text. Paul asks the remnant question. I ask then, has God rejected his people? What's Paul asking? Has God rejected his people? Who are his people? Israel, the Jews, the historical remnant. Paul's saying, has God rejected his people? What's his answer? By no means. By no means. In another place, he says that the promises and covenants of God are irrevocable. There's some sense in which the Jewish people do remain with a special relationship with God. There's some sense in which that's true because the Bible says so. The New Testament says so. Paul says, God has not rejected his people. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. So Paul says, I know that God hasn't rejected the historical remnant. How do I know? Because he hasn't rejected me, and I'm one of them. You see? So he saw in his own experience evidence that God had not rejected the Jews. Notice what he says further. Do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah, how he appeals to God against Israel? This is a text we just noticed. Lord, they've killed your prophets, demolished your altars. I alone am left. That's a remnant word, by the way, left. And they seek my life. But what is God's reply to him? I've kept for myself 7,000. Verse 5, so too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. Who is that remnant? Those among the Jews who are faithful to God. And what for Paul would be the best evidence in his day that a Jew was faithful to God? If they followed Jesus. All right? I'm sure there were faithful Jews who never heard of Jesus or heard of him in a way that they felt they had to reject. But for Paul, clear evidence that God had not rejected the Jews is that Jews were coming to Jesus. And so, for Paul, the faithful remnant among the historical remnant would have been those Jews who followed Jesus. But if you go to the end of chapter 11, Paul envisions a day when all the Jews will come back. You remember that text? Ellen White spends a whole chapter on that text in Acts of the Apostles. But he envisions a day when the Jews en masse will return to faithfulness again. And for Paul, that would be an eschatological remnant of great excitement. So let's summarize Paul. Standing where Paul stands, who are the historical remnant? Old Testament Israel, historical remnant, all right? Old Testament Israel, Exodus, exile, all that stuff. There's a clearly marked people of God, not universally faithful, mixed bag. Remnants always are, historical remnants. You can identify them, count them, etc. Among those Jews were some who followed Jesus. So for Paul, the faithful remnant were the followers of Jesus. For Paul, who were the eschatological remnant? Would have been the end-time church. And if Paul could be resurrected and join us today, and if Pastor Samuel would say, Brother Paul, I have to tell you that there's 2 billion people in the world today from every nation on earth that read your books and are trying to follow them in one way or another. What would Paul say? I think he'd say, never saw it coming. He had an idea that the end time remnant would be bigger than anything he understood. But I think if he were alive today, he would say, I never would have saw it. I never even heard about that Western Hemisphere of yours. You know, you mean there's hundreds of millions of followers over there? I can't believe it. You know, say, the end time remnant is bigger, more international, unpredictable, surprise. All right, keep this in mind. This is the biblical concept of remnant. You can think of remnant in historical terms as this mixed group of visible institutions. You could think of remnant in present tense terms as those who are united to God in heart. You can think of remnant in future terms as what God is yet going to do in this world. All right? So let's go to the end time. Revelation 12, 17 has a remnant. And that remnant is end time. They follow God's revelations. They hold the faith of Jesus Christ. And they are bigger, more international, more unpredictable. Take a look at Revelation 14, 6. I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having the everlasting gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. And if Revelation were written today, do you think it would also add, and religion? Do you think there are religions in this world that God can't reach? Like Islam? All right? Revelation itself says this message will be universal. We already admitted the Adventist message is not at this point of worldwide significance. The world is not talking about it at this point. You see? So that vision has not yet been accomplished. The historical remnant is in place. There are many faithful ones among us. But the end time vision has not yet taken place in its fullness. Just a hint. All right? I don't take this numerically or percentage-wise or anything like that. But I just want you to see, we tend to think of remnant as a handful of survivors. And normally that's the case. But remnants are not always minorities. Take a look at this one. And by the way, this is an end time picture. This is just before the seventh trumpet. So this is the same time period as Revelation 10. That time of the end. At that hour, there was a great earthquake, and a tenth of the city fell. How much? A tenth of the city fell. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake. And the remnant became afraid and gave glory to the God of heaven. All right, if 10% of the city fell, how big is the remnant here? 9/10. All right? So here's a remnant that's 90%. But you're saying, all right, but that's not a faithful remnant. This is the great city. This is the bad guys. Well, take a look. What does this remnant do? They become afraid, and give glory to the God of heaven. Does that sound like Revelation 14, 7? Fear God and give Him glory, for the hour of His judgment has come? Sounds like Revelation 11, 13 is an answer to Revelation 14, 7. where a large portion of Babylon, if you wish, the great city, comes to God, responds to the three angels' messages. Now, like I said, don't put a percentage on it or anything like that, but there's hints at least that what God would like to do with the remnant message is way bigger than we've thought thus far. There's hints, at least, of that possibility. Let's summarize. Let's take the standpoint, all right, 2010. Who's the historical remnant of Revelation? I'll be very straight. I believe it's historic Adventism. And what I mean by that is the Adventist church institution that was founded in the 19th century, grounded in the book of Revelation, and still exists today. But let's be straight up with this. Are historical remnants faithful? Not always. Most of the time, they're a mixture of faithful and unfaithful. Nothing arrogant here, folk. If we think because we're a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church that we're better than anybody else, take a look at the remnants of history, folk. It's a misunderstanding of remnant to be in any way proud or arrogant about that. Remnant is, in the historical sense, human beings banded together in response to an action of God. That's what religion's all about, by the way. Religion is a human response to a mighty act of God. And as a human response, it is a fallible response. It doesn't always get it right. It usually keeps one or two really big things in mind and kind of messes up the rest. That's the pattern. That's history. All right? There's nothing to brag about here. Who would the faithful remnant be? That would be those among Adventists who have a clear sense of the role and identity here. Now, I'm going to be honest. I don't see Lutherans and Catholics there. I'm not talking about salvation. Please just don't misunderstand me. But the remnant of Revelation has a unique message and a unique mission that no other body on this earth has taken hold of. By the way, we had conversations with the Lutheran World Federation, the top leaders of the Lutheran World Federation, that took place over several years. And an interesting outcome of that is they came to say, you know, this Revelation stuff, we've never been into it. Like Luther, you know, Revelation seems to be kind of a not that profitable book. But you guys are really into it. And we believe that you ought to give that message. In other words, in a sense, the Lutheran World Federation gave us permission to be what we are, to be unique. Because they recognized that we had a message to the world that they could not give. And that the world needed to hear. And I respected that. You know, they in the end said, well, we don't agree with that, but we believe that God has called you to a special mission and you need to carry it out. That was, I couldn't ask for a better conclusion to that kind of a conversation. So yes, I think there's a unique mission that only those who have grasped what the book of Revelation is all about can really give. Are all Adventists faithful? Probably not. Probably not. But those who have a clear sense of that mission and identity, and that's somewhat what we're trying to establish here this afternoon, those are the ones who can be the bearers of that identity toward God's plans for the future. And what are those plans? They're still ahead. But the Bible would tell us that they're what? Bigger, more international, more unpredictable than we've thought. In other words, what lies ahead is going to surprise us if we are faithful to that mission. Now, there's no guarantee. There's going to be a thread between the historical and the eschatological remnant. God didn't bring this church into existence for nothing. What we don't know is how thick that thread will be. Will the institution itself be the means of reaching the entire world? I certainly hope so. But history would suggest it's not written in stone. It may be a few individuals who have caught the vision, caught the idea and plant those seeds in other places. That may in the long run be how it all works out. Well, this is about the end of the information as far as the Bible goes. And I could just stop right here. But you'd probably want me to speculate just a little bit, wouldn't you? About how that might happen. How God could go from a small body of people who often seem a little bit messed up and have a movement that would sweep through Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Catholicism, whatever. Is that even imaginable? How would this happen? Well, let me take you on a little journey and see if it makes sense to you. And here I'm not claiming any endorsement from the GC committee or anything like that. This is my own vision, and it's based upon history, the history of religions in particular, and based upon this biblical study that we have done. An interesting thing is happening right now. In the past, when Adventists talked about prophecy, they tended to use marginal historians. They'd pick on a historian here and there who said something that sounded good to us. But these were not usually historians of worldwide renown, and is often in footnotes rather than the main text. The interesting thing is happening is some of the world's leading historians are sounding more and more like great controversy. Just in the last 10 years, I'm going to share three historians with you. We'll try not to make that boring. I know that can be. Three historians with you. I know each of them personally. Each of them is considered the world's leading scholar in that field. So we're not talking about marginal people. We're not talking about Adventists who are carrying a torch for the Adventist church. These are serious historians out there who are seeing some things that I think should be significant to us. First of these is James Dunn. James Dunn is a British evangelical who wrote a book called The Partings of the Ways, How Christianity and Judaism Broke Apart in the Early Centuries. Dunn is not a Seventh-day Adventist, and he's considered the world's leading expert on first-century Christianity. And basically, his thesis is this. When Jesus came, he didn't come to start a new religion. He came to reform the religion that was already there, Judaism. At its beginning, Christianity was not a new religion. Judaism and Christianity were the same religion. And Christianity, as we know it, emerged out of Judaism. At the beginning, Christianity and Judaism served the same God, read the same Bible, the Old Testament, worshipped in the same temple, and were basically one people. You could not, if you were a Roman, distinguish a Jew and a Christian, because they were saying the same things, and they were worshiping in the same places, and they were basically talking the same language. So, that's how it all started. But by the end of the first century, the parting of the ways had begun, and it was fairly complete by around 135, about 100 years after Jesus. And here is Dunn's unique contribution. He says, whenever religions break apart, both of them tend to lose something. Why? Because as they break apart, they want to distinguish themselves from each other. And it's almost as if Jews and Christians sat around a table and divided up the spoils. Now, you could almost hear the Jews saying, you know, this Messiah business, we believe in that, but the more we talk about Messiah, people think we're Christians, because you guys are always talking about it. So why don't you have the Messiah? And I can envision Christians saying around that, well, you know this Sabbath business? You know, we love the Sabbath, but whenever we keep the Sabbath, people think we're Jews, so why don't you keep that? And the Jews said, well, you know this eschatology business. Whenever we start talking eschatology, the Romans come and smack us upside the head, and that doesn't feel good. So you have the eschatology. You talk about the end of time. We'll just focus on the present. And the Christians said, well, you know this law business, obedience, and all that stuff. Whenever we talk about that, people think we're Jews, so why don't you have that? And so Jews and Christians broke apart, and each of them gave up some things that were core to their being out of that breakage. And it's true. Whenever religions break apart, They tend to both lose something. When Adventism broke away from some of the Protestant churches, what did Adventism lose? In the first generation, the gospel. We were so busy talking about the distinctives, by the second generation, nobody knew how they were saved. And we had to recapture that. You see, when religions break apart, losses occur. A very significant insight. Second historian, Bart Ehrman, wrote a book called Lost Christianities, The Battles for Scripture and the Faiths We Never Knew. Bart Ehrman is not a Seventh-day Adventist. He's actually a secular scholar who doesn't claim to believe at all. He calls himself an agnostic. But he's the world's leading authority on the early Christian church, second, third, and fourth centuries of the Christian church. And by the way, his doctoral assistant during the years he wrote this book was a student of mine, a Seventh-day Adventist. And I asked him, he says, how much influence did you have in this book? He says, none. He says, I didn't know he was writing it. So unless he gave him a copy of Great Controversy or something, I don't know. But he didn't think he had a lot of influence. So Ehrman comes up with this on his own, and he basically says this. Early Christianity actually had five or six versions. In other words, people took the New Testament and emphasized different things. Even within the New Testament, there's a difference of emphasis. Matthew and James focus more on Judaism and obedience and so on. Paul focuses on the gospel, justification by faith. John focuses on relationship with God. So even within the New Testament, there are different emphases among the writers. And so Ehrman points out that by the second and third centuries, there were five or six versions of Christianity that were options. Of these, only one became orthodox, as we call it. That, in other words, Christianity as we know it is one of these five or six. Only one of them. Christianity as we know it is not a blend of these five or six. It is an elimination of all but one of these five or six. A different version of Christianity was accepted by Jesus' own family. In other words, Jesus' own cousins and nephews and grandnephews and so on did not buy into the version of Christianity we follow today. And by we, I mean everybody. You know, today everyone's either orthodox or reacting against it. Those earlier versions of Christianity are gone. Most of these could be traced to something in the New Testament, but all but the orthodox were suppressed by the fourth century. And who does Ehrman name as the bad guy that wiped out all these options for Christianity? A fellow called Constantine. Does that sound familiar? It says Constantine came along and he wanted to unite the empire by using Christianity. So he got rid of any version of Christianity that didn't sound right to him. So Ehrman laments this. And interestingly enough, one of these non-survivors was Jewish Christianity. And Ehrman tells us that Jewish Christianity had the following characteristics that were unique. They were accepted by Jesus' own family. They kept the Sabbath. They emphasized obedience. And they emphasized the importance of the Old Testament for Christian faith. Does that sound like anyone you know? All right? Now, these Jewish Christians also had many teachings we would not subscribe to. But the point is, there was a version of Christianity that had these things that are so special to Adventists wiped out, gone. With Constantine. And Ehrman, though he is not himself a believer, laments this. He says, Christianity is not what it could have been. And perhaps even today, Christianity might be able to come back to itself if it were to restore some of the things it had lost. Fascinating. Sounds like great controversy. What were the consequences of Constantine? Parting of the ways with Judaism. From Constantine on, there's no idea of Jews and Christians ever getting together. Narrow and selective readings of the New Testament. Does that ever happen in Christian churches? People pick and choose their texts and end up with their doctrines. General ignorance of the Old Testament. And it also precipitated Islam. And this is a piece that many people in the West don't know, and many Muslims don't know. But when Muhammad first began to receive what he called revelations, he was not trying to start a new religion either. I believe there's abundant evidence in the Quran itself that the original vision of Islam was not a new religion, but a restoration of what Judaism and Christianity had lost when they broke apart. You want evidence? Let's take a look at a few texts from the Quran. First of all, Muhammad believed that the prophets of Judaism and Christianity were to be respected as equals with himself. Now, Muslims don't believe that today, generally. But this is what the Quran teaches. Let me show you. These are the words of God as Muhammad understood them. Say ye, these are orders to Muhammad, say, we believe in Allah, that's God, and the revelation given to us, Muslims, Muhammad, and to Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, and the descendants of Jacob, and that given to Moses and Jesus, and that given to all prophets from their Lord. We make no difference between one and another of them. Did you know that? The Quran says that? That Moses and Jesus are held in equal esteem by Muslims, or should be? Another text that says the same kind of thing. Those who deny Allah and His messengers, plural, and those who wish to separate Allah from His messengers, saying, we believe in some but reject others, they are in truth unbelievers. Isn't that amazing? In other words, a Muslim who rejects Jesus is an unbeliever. A Muslim who rejects Moses, who rejects the Scriptures, is an unbeliever. This is not the saying of somebody who thinks Christianity and Judaism are lost and we're going to start something new. This is rather the language of restoration. To those who believe in Allah and His messengers, plural, and make no distinction between any of the messengers, we shall soon give their due rewards. In other words, he did not believe he was bringing a new message. He believed that he was bringing the same message that Moses and Jesus preached, that David and that Abraham and Ishmael had preached. It was the same message. Now, that's not a picture most people have understood. The Scriptures of Judaism and Christianity are normative for the Muslim. Again, most Muslims don't know this. Most Christians certainly don't. The evidence. And by the way, if you are making notes, the numbers there, the number in parentheses is the surah or chapter in the Quran, and then the verse or ayah is ayat is verse 3 and 4, and so on. So you can look these up if you want. It is Allah who sent down to thee, step by step, in truth, the book. What's the book? That's the Quran, all right? The book that Muhammad was receiving. Confirming what went before it. Confirming what? And he sent down the law of Moses and the gospel of Jesus before this as a guide to mankind. What was Muhammad doing? Confirming what the Scriptures taught. This is not the language of a new religion. It's not the language of some radical transformation. It's rather the language of one who has come to restore the truth that had been lost. Another text. If thou wert in doubt as to what we have revealed unto thee. Here's an interesting one. God is saying to Muhammad, if you're in doubt as to what's going on here, if you don't understand what I'm doing, what should he do? The blue. Ask those who have been reading the book from before thee. What is the book here? It's clearly God's revelation, not just the Quran, but also the Bible. In other words, Muhammad, if you don't really understand what's going on here, go talk to the Jews and Christians. They've been into this before you. So he's supposed to go back and confer with those who have been studying the Bible to gain clarity on what it is God is doing in his life. Also, one more thing, Judaism and Christianity are valid expressions of Islam. In other words, according to the Quran, it isn't necessary to convert to Islam to be submitted to God, to be faithful to God. Say to the people of the book, who are they? That's a term in the Quran for Jews and Christians. Say to the people of the book and those who are unlearned, do ye not also submit yourselves? That word submit is the word for Islam. Do you not also become Muslims? If they do, they're in right guidance. But if they turn back, thy duty is to convey the message, and in Allah's sight are all his servants. Even if Jews and Christians choose not to become Muslims, they're still servants of God. And finally, this is even more powerful. Had not Allah checked one set of people by means of another, there would have been pulled down monasteries, churches, synagogues, and mosques in which the name of Allah is commemorated in abundant measure. In other words, God is being faithfully worshipped, not just in mosques, but in synagogues, monasteries, and churches as well. This is not the message of somebody who's trying to tear it all down. All right? Many people have not read the Quran. Many Muslims have not read the Quran, or if they've read it only in a language they don't understand. But the message of the Quran is a surprising and shocking one many times. All right, so basically what I understand this to be saying is that Muhammad had a vision of restoring Judaism and Christianity to what had been lost, to bring the faith in God back together again. Did he succeed? No. Even within his lifetime, some terrible battles came between Jews and Muslims, and as a result, the parting of the ways occurred again. And now you had a three-way disjuncture. And what happens when religions break apart? They all tend to lose something. So Islam no longer resembles a lot of the teachings in the Quran. It has changed through the centuries too, just as Catholicism has changed and many Protestant churches have changed, you see. So, what's the end result of this threefold parting of the ways? I was thinking about this one day, and I was thinking, you know, usually when we think of other faiths, we think about what's wrong with them, right? And try to point out. And you know, it isn't hard to compare the best of your religion with the worst of someone else's and come away feeling pretty good. I thought, let's be fair. Just once. All right? Let me just ask the question. What is it about these other faiths? What's at the core of their faith that would be really exciting for a person that really is in some way a faithful representation of God? So I thought about that. And I said, well, let's go to Christianity. What are the core values of Christianity that Jews and Muslims would reject, but that we look at and say, yeah, that's, you know, there's something there. How about gospel, grace, Jesus? Okay? Would you agree that that's pretty core to all Christians? You know, Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, whatever. Pretty core to all Christians. And pretty generally rejected by Jews and Muslims. All right. What about Jews? What are the core values of Judaism that are generally rejected by the others? I would say law, obedience, Sabbath. All right. What about Islam? What are the core values of Islam that are generally rejected by the others? Submission, judgment, eschatology. Many Adventists don't realize that, like Adventism, Islam is an eschatological religion. The fundamental question of Islam is, what will matter at the end of life? When you come to the end of your life, what's going to matter? Are you going to wish you'd have played more video games? Wish you had watched more TV? Or wish you'd spent more time with kids, more time with God? You see? When a Muslim comes to the end of life, he or she discovers there's two things that really matter. Any idea what those are? God and character. The works that you've done, the character that you've developed through your life. What's the one thing Ellen White says you can take to heaven? Your character. Interesting. Right, many people do not realize that there are significant similarities in the way that Adventists think and the way Muslims think. It's just because we don't know what Muslims think. So it's sort of a surprise. All right, so those are the core values of each of these three faiths that in breaking apart, they hung on to that. That's the good stuff they hung on to. All right, one more historian. Philip Jenkins, The New Christendom. Jenkins sort of watches the geographical movement of Christianity. Christianity began as an Eastern religion in the Middle East. It migrated to Europe, and in migrating to Europe, it changed in character. Can you imagine that's true? Christianity is quite different than it was as an Eastern religion. Recently, it's migrated to North America, and America has become the center of gravity of Christian faith. But now, Christianity is beginning to move south and east, back to the developing world. It's becoming more southern and more eastern, less American and less European. I remember one time I was at a conference, and Jenkins and I were both speakers, and after his presentation, I raised my hand. I said, you're an Anglican. He's an Anglican, from American Anglican. And I said, your work is really tremendous, and you've studied the Anglican Church, but I could tell you, if you had studied the Adventist Church, you could have written this book 25 years earlier. And he grinned, and he acknowledged, yeah, you're right. He says, I'm coming to realize that where we are going, you have already been. The Adventist Church today is probably, the majority of the Adventist Church is south of the equator and east of the Atlantic Ocean, and that there's really no other church like that in the fullness as the Adventist Church is. What Jenkins says is Christianity as a whole is returning to its roots. It's going back to the East, and in the process, we'll learn things that it had lost. Now, when Jenkins was asked in an Adventist audience once, what book of the Bible do you think would be most helpful in keeping Christianity together at this time? He answered, believe it or not, focus on the book of Revelation. He says, I see Adventists perhaps as a people that more than any others can help us pull this thing together. Because I think the book of Revelation is crucial. So let's review real quick. What does the book of Revelation say about the remnant? End of earth history, close of Daniel's time prophecies, prophetic visionary gift, worldwide attention, worldwide significance. What are the messages? The gospel, Daniel and Revelation, sanctuary, keeping the commandments, warning of end time deception, relationship with Jesus, hour of judgment, Sabbath. You seeing what I'm seeing? The remnant of Revelation, their message has the core values of all three faiths. Now, this is a 1900-year-old book, almost 2,000 now. I guess it is more than 2,000 now, isn't it? 95 now. 2095, it'll be 2000. All right. But it's an almost 2,000-year-old book. And in it, God is saying, at the end of time, I need a people who will be teaching the gospel in this form. Is that an accident? or did God know exactly where things were going? As prepared a message to go to the world right at that time and in that form. The reality is here. This is the one message that could unite the face of the world. We could go further. Missionaries to Southern Asia tell me that Adventism is closer to Hinduism, Buddhism, and the Chinese religions than it is to Christianity in those same areas. There's more in common. There's something about the remnant of Revelation, something about that message that has ties to just about everyone. In fact, if you were to ask yourself, which of the three are we most distant from as Adventists? Which of the three is the hardest for us to relate to? It might be the Christian one. Because gospel, grace, and Jesus have sometimes been a struggle for us. And I wonder if when we get those right, will the message go with power? What would be the biggest barrier to us playing a role like this in the world? Our own pride, our own exclusiveness, our own unwillingness to really get out there and talk to the people and maybe learn from them what they're coming from and understanding what God has done in their lives. The hardest point here for most Adventists is the Islam thing. They can't imagine what on earth Adventists and Islam have in common. Let me just quick trip to the Middle East, and then we're done with this, and we can start the questions. In the Middle East, everybody knows who a Christian is and who a Muslim is. There's no ambiguity whatsoever. I remember riding on a bus, Muslim bus driver, and every time, after about an hour or so, he'd kind of look at me funny and say, "You're from America, aren't you?" "Yeah." "And how come you're not a Christian?" I used to get offended. You know, and I'd defend myself. "Yeah, I am." "Nah, you're not." "Nah, you're not. I know." Well, I said, "What's going on here?" And I found out that if you walk into a grocery store in the Middle East and there's alcohol on the shelf, what do you know? It's a Christian store. If there's no alcohol on the shelf, it's a Muslim store. So one of the markers between Jews and Christians, did we just lose the computer? That's okay. We're right about at the end. Battery went. Took about an hour and 15. There you go. Now we know. Alcohol is one of the markers between Christians and Muslims. On which side do Adventists fall? Okay. Second one, pork. If a Muslim wants to prove to his family that he has converted and become a Christian, he sits down in front of them, drinks a glass of wine, eats a piece of pork, they know that he's a Christian now. On which side do Adventists go? Marker number three. You walk into a travel agency or a place of business and the women look like Vogue magazine, what do you know? It's a Christian or a Jewish establishment. If they look quite modest, it's a Muslim establishment. You ask a Middle Easterner what they think of the Pope. If you get a positive review, it's a Christian. If you get a negative review, it's a Muslim. You ask a Middle Easterner what they think of America. If it's a positive review, they're probably Christian or Jewish. If it's a negative review, they're Muslim. You ask a Muslim what their greatest fear for the world today is, and they'll probably tell you an alliance between the Pope and the United States. Where do Adventists fit here? You see? Now here's my point. My point is not that at every point Adventists and Muslims are the same. It's not the case. But the reality is God has created a people that lacks the barriers that prevent Muslims and Christians from engaging each other. In Acts 15, there were barriers that prevented Jews and Gentiles from engaging each other. In the book of Revelation, it identifies a people who will not have the barriers that Muslims and Christians have in relate. The barriers that occurred when they broke apart. God has created a people that has the potential to bring together people who would never otherwise talk to each other. You see? The eschatological remnant. Bigger, more international, more unpredictable. Can we as a body play that role? Or will pride, exclusivism, you know, we are better than they, or we don't need that kind in our church? Think about it, folks. Let's just talk Fallbrook for a moment. If next Sabbath 300 Muslims walked in the door wearing the robes, the whole garb, and came in and sat down and says, we would like to be part of this body, would you be excited? I hope so. I hope so. But think about it. Would you really be excited? Or after a couple weeks, you'd be thinking, what are we doing here? You see? That's the question. All right? Well, enough of that. I don't think that remnant needs in any way to be an arrogant concept. It's simply we stumbled into a message in the book of Revelation that anybody can read and anybody can follow. Just because we stumbled into it first doesn't mean anything. It's not making us better than anyone else. It's more of a responsibility than anything else. So, anyway, where would you like to go? We can take maybe 20 minutes, 30 at the most, and then we'll let you go for sure. Yeah.